When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Rex Factor. This week, Catherine Parr.
Your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the Queen and Prince consorts of England, from Elswith to Prince Philip. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Rex Factor Pod. Like us on Facebook, email rexfactorpodcast.hotmail.com, and sign up for bonus content at www.patreon.com/rexfactor. And today, as you'll have heard, we are reviewing Catherine Parr, the sixth and final consort of the six wives of Henry VIII.
We're there. And finally, the question is answered.
That question being,
who is Catherine Parr?
Catherine Parr indeed often gets forgotten about, but as we'll see, fascinating character in her own right, far more than just a footnote to her predecessors.
Biography!
Catherine Parr was born in about 1512, the daughter of Sir Thomas Parr and Maud Green. The Parrs are a notable northern family in southern Westmorland, as it was at the time, so Cumbria. Based at Kendal Castle, though by the time Catherine was around, it was Northamptonshire and London where the family actually lived.
Yeah.
Thomas Parr, very much coming man at court. He was knighted at Henry VIII's coronation, a veteran of the Battle of the Spurs in France, and one of four men to have the honour of bearing the canopy over Henry's daughter, Mary, at her christening.
Oh, right. Yeah, jolly good.
And he marries Maud Green, and she becomes one of Catherine of Aragon's ladies-in-waiting. And indeed, they're both so close to the Queen that Catherine of Aragon becomes Catherine Parr's godmother, meaning that Henry's final wife is literally named after his first wife.
Oh, my word. Catherine of Aragon was her godmother?
Yes.
Of course, that's...
So it's not just like, oh, Catherine of Aragon's the queen, let's have that name. It's
literally
because that's her godmother. She's named after Catherine of Aragon.
Oh, my word. Henry, the show is over, my love. Come on.
Now, unfortunately, Thomas Parr's glittering career came to a sudden halt when he died, not because of Henry, but because of plague, sadly, in 1517, when Catherine's only 5 years old.
Isn't that surprising? Yeah. It's only the second biggest killer in the time was the plague after Henry.
Catherine's mother, Maud, never remarries. Instead, she manages the family estates independently and dedicates herself to her children's education. And she devises quite an impressive educational programme that led to her household becoming something of a finishing school for gentry sons and daughters.
Oh, right. Oh, like Catherine Howard.
Yes, but this one is a rather more reputable and well-respected establishment than...
Yeah.
The rather lax arrangements Catherine Howard had. Because it's a particularly rigorous and scholarly programme her mother sets up, Catherine Parr is possibly the best, or at least one of the best, educated of Henry's queens. So she read and wrote Latin, conversant in Greek, fluent in French and Italian, as well as having various other interests such as medicine.
Like Anne Boleyn. She
Anne Boleyn, yes.
In lots of respects,
So Anne Boleyn, very well educated, very intelligent as well. Anne's probably has got a better schooling in terms of being a courtier because she goes off to Europe. Whereas perhaps Catherine Parr just focuses on the academia side of things.
Schoolwork, yeah. Oh, so there were like two different routes. You to get ahead, you either it's who you know or what you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's where perhaps not having Thomas Parr around anymore, you know, if he'd still been alive,
I see.
Established contacts, she might have gone off somewhere else, but instead they've kind of had to hunker down a bit just within the Parr family.
Yeah.
In 1529, when she's about 16 or 17, she marries Edward Burr, the heir to the Lord of Gainsborough, and joins a rather less supportive household. So her father-in-law, Baron Burr, is an abusive tyrant, actually threw out one of his other daughters-in-law and his grandchildren, calling them bastards. Just because he obviously didn't like her, took against her. So the children live in fear of him. But thankfully, when Catherine's mother Maud visits them in 1530, she persuades Baron Burr to provide Catherine and her husband with an independent residence at Curtin and Lindsay, a few miles down the road, so they're able to move out away from him and live an independent life.
It just sounds like he has mental health problems.
Well, indeed, there are mental health problems in the family, and Edward himself, her husband, is said to have suffered from a distracted memory.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to be fair, it sounds like something that you could be diagnosed with.
What of it? Yeah.
It's maybe more of a euphemism here rather than just a literal description of the problem. And he dies just a few years later in 1533 when Catherine's only 21.
Oh, dear.
And sadly, her mother Maud had died the year before this, and Baron Burr, as you can expect, just washes his hands of her once his son's died. So all on her own, really, without anyone to support her. She goes to stay with one of her kinswomen, who is Catherine Neville, a dowager, at Sizer Castle near Kendal.
Does she have any money or land?
No, she doesn't have any money from Baron Burr. Her other sister isn't married, so she doesn't have a household. A younger sister isn't married at this point, so she doesn't have a household for her to join. So there isn't really anywhere else for her to go. So she has to find somewhere, and it's with Catherine Neville. But it's through Catherine Neville in 1534, the following year, that she finds her second husband, John Neville, the third Baron Latimer.
Oh.
Now, he's much older than Catherine, 40 to her about 22 at this stage, and he already has two teenage children. But it's not only a beneficial match, because it makes her a lady, so she becomes Lady Latimer.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seems to be a genuinely affectionate marriage. So Catherine kept his copy of the New Testament in which he'd inscribed his name for the rest of her life.
Hmm.
However, it was not to be a quiet life. They were living at Snape Castle in Yorkshire, which was midway between Durham and York. And consequently, a couple of years after their marriage, they are right in the eye of the storm of the Pilgrimage of Grace.
In
1536, the major northern uprising against the dissolution of the monasteries. And Latimer, her husband, is dragged from his home by a mob demanding that he become one of their leaders. Catherine herself, though, comes into danger because when Latimer goes to London to negotiate with Henry or Henry's representatives, they suspect his loyalties back in the north and ransack Snape Castle, take Catherine and the stepchildren hostage and threaten to kill them if he doesn't come back. Thankfully, though, he does manage to negotiate their release when he returns. Though after the rebellion, it's actually his life that's then in danger because obviously Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell very much suspect that he was, he was a leader of the in the rebellion, but they suspect that he was ideologically supportive of it. So it's perhaps in part because of his connection with Catherine, whose uncle and brother had served with distinction in suppressing the rebellion, that Latimer is spared his life.
Phew.
Catherine doesn't seem to have enjoyed the isolated existence at Snape Castle, and the Pilgrimage of Grace experience probably puts a nail into that coffin, so it seems to have insisted that they then move to London. And in here, she really revels in the much livelier and intellectually stimulating atmosphere of court life.
Yeah.
Lord Latimer falls seriously ill in 1542, and Catherine nurses him until his death the following year. So she becomes now a wealthy widow. He leaves her various northern estates and monies and whatnot, but she doesn't really want to leave court and go back up north. So she secures herself a permanent place at court by becoming a lady-in-waiting to Henry's daughter, Mary.
Because
obviously they have a personal connection, obviously with Catherine's connection to Catherine Aragon, and her parents.
So they're they're stepsisters. No, they're god-sisters. If there are such a thing.
God sisters, yeah, that's a nice way of putting it. Because her husband's death is rather timely for Catherine because she has become acquainted with a chap called Thomas Seymour.
Right.
Now, he is a younger brother to Jane Seymour, a courageous soldier and sometime poet with a taste for fashion. He's got piratical good looks and a bit of a wild reputation.
Well, something's up here because she's going to... Clearly, there's sauciness afoot. You know... Don't go any further in your descriptions, but so Henry's going to be a fourth husband.
Well, Seymour starts courting Catherine basically as soon as Latimer dies, and she seems to have quickly fallen in love with him, so she later writes to Seymour, "My mind was fully bent the other time I was at liberty to marry you before any man I know." Well, unfortunately, it transpires that Catherine is not at liberty to marry, because she's caught the eye of Henry VIII.
God, he's the great black hole is sucking in another victim.
He's now 52 years old and in pretty bad health. As you said, he's got his ulcers. It's very much end of game, ill, paranoid tyrant.
Is he bitter? Or is he actually all right with the world?
He's been apparently sad, pensive and sighing, having been unmarried for over a year following the execution of Catherine Howard.
Do you know, that's what makes him a little bit more terrifying, you know, that he's actually like quite a soppy, wet romantic. He'll love so intensely he removes the head. It's really creepy. And then...
Anyway, so Henry's been a bit down in the dumps after Catherine Howard, but apparently he's reinvigorated by a military victory against Scotland. And as such, he bade his daughter Mary to come to court for Christmas with her ladies, because he feels a bit more perky and he wants some female company. It's probably at this point that he spots Catherine Parr. So Henry sets about wooing. And for Henry, obviously, that means bribing her. So spends thousands of pounds purchasing clothes of all the latest fashions and appoints her brother to the Privy Chamber and the Garter.
Yeah.
Also makes him receiver for a Riddle.
Oh, that's a nice job near us. Yeah.
And another person to get a new job was Thomas Seymour, who is appointed Special Ambassador to Brussels.
Is that a good post?
It's more the fact that he is conveniently posted out of the country.
Oh, I see.
The moves Henry's got in his locker.
Yeah, we'll put the husband over there, put the clothes in front of her, see what happens. And what happen?
Well, usually we don't know what the lucky recipients of Henry's affections really thought about it. But in this case, that's not true. Because Catherine was in love with Thomas Seymour, and she is perfectly aware of the pitfalls of marrying Henry. So she later tells Seymour that she prayed numerous times for guidance on this, and that God withstood my will therein most vehemently for a time. Through his grace and goodness, he made that possible which seemed to me impossible. That was, made me renounce utterly mine own will and to follow his most willingly. So in other words, she feels like she's got to accept Henry's proposal. That's what God has decided. She's meant to be queen, whether she likes it or not.
Right. But it's not completely consensless.
She's accepted that this is her part. This is like her fate. This is what she's meant to do. It's not what she wants to do, but she's accepted it's what she's meant to do. Not just because Henry's the king, but because...
Quite a nasty place to have a grey area, isn't it, if you'll excuse the expression?
Yes, I mean, I think fundamentally we can take from this that she didn't really want to marry Henry. So, on the 12th of July, 1543, just 4 months after her second husband's death, Catherine marries for the third time, becoming the sixth wife of Henry VIII. So they get married in a small ceremony at Hampton Court. Both of Henry's daughters, Mary and Elizabeth, are in attendance, though, at the wedding.
Well, it's just what you do on a Thursday in Hampton Court by then, isn't it?
Yeah. So Catherine Parr is now Queen of England, but what will her role be? Because it's often said that she is basically Henry's nurse.
Mm.
She's seen as a sort of dowdy old matron who just tends to his ulcerated legs.
The entirety of my knowledge of her, in fact.
Well, I'm about to burst that bubble. David Starkey's argued that the very idea of this would have been regarded as absurd, even indecent, at the time. Because Henry has male doctors who attend to his medical needs, as well as his own remedies. Mm. And as always, when Henry marries, he marries for love.
What? He marries for his love.
His love, yes, not. Yes. So although Catherine is older than his previous wives, about 31, in terms of when the relationship starts.
Yeah.
Catherine, she is beautiful. She has a fashionably pale complexion and auburn hair. Also, as you said, highly intelligent and has also got a very naturally sort of kind and friendly disposition.
So she's not the much... Oh, I mean, she's an older woman then, but yeah, she's not... I'm imagining someone who's middle-aged and tending to his wounds, but actually she's quite a young, beautiful queen.
Mm, yeah. I mean, also, obviously, you know, third husband for her. So again, that's a difference from the other five, that he is not her first husband.
But that's brilliant. I think I'm going to really like her, because I like the idea of someone still being young in that age with such patriarchy going on, and she's got the measure by then. She's on her third husband, and, well, really her fourth man, I guess, fourth relationship. She knows the system, doesn't she? She's going to, I hope, anyway, use that to good effect.
And after the debacle with Catherine Howard, Catherine Parr's virtue is one of her most prized qualities for Henry. So Robert Hutchinson noted that her personal motto of "to be useful in all I do" has the ring of a sensible, practical and dutiful girl guide captain.
Well, I rather like it.
And Henry is genuinely enamoured with her. That's why he marries her. He calls her sweetheart, lets her sit on his lap.
Oh, God. Oh, it sounds like, oh, no.
Yeah. And he even leaves little poems for her. Oh. Here's one. "Remember this writer when you do pray, for he is yours. None can say nay."
I mean, it's another way that I bear a striking resemblance to Henry VIII, isn't it? Oh dear, he needs to... I'll have him for a Tuesday talk. What do I mean? Book review.
He showers her with gifts, and Catherine does rather seem to enjoy indulging in a life of luxury, from jewellery and high fashion. So apparently in 1 year she ordered 47 pairs of shoes.
Wow.
Also expensive oils, and also she enjoys rather indulgent milk baths.
I've always fancied that. I've had porridge in the bath.
Hmm.
You know, when you have chicken pox, you have to put oats in the bath.
Yeah,
that does feel really nice. Well, we can do that for Rex Factor. Yeah, maybe we'll get in a milky bath.
A milky bath. But it's a weird thing to say, but, you know, she also has all these lovely sort of oils and perfumes. She's got special lozenges she carries around in a box for Bertha. She probably smells great.
She is undoubtedly the most excellently smelling monarch we've had. Well, recorded smelling monarch we've had.
She also enjoys dancing, music and hunting, sort of very much matching Henry's favourite pursuits as well. So they've got things that they've got in common with each other. Now, like her three immediate predecessors, Catherine isn't granted a coronation. She doesn't even get one of those little river processions that Henry had seemed to like to use as an alternative, cheaper version. But that doesn't mean that she's of a lesser status. So although she's actually very inexperienced as a courtier, because she had only just come to court, she's more intelligent than most at court, and Cromwell's death in 1540 meant that there is actually a greater opportunity to influence Henry than there had been for quite some time, because he's missing that right-hand man that he'd had.
Oh, right, there wasn't anyone filling his shoes then?
I mean, the role of Lord Chancellor, whatever, the positions are filled, but that close
that
one-on-one
person,
isn't really there. And so Catherine is very quickly able to exert her own influence. She establishes close relationships with all three of Henry's children, bringing them to court as part of one household on various occasions, and she also helps to restore Mary and Elizabeth to the line of succession. Catherine's authority reaches its apex in 1544. Henry had declared war on France just a few weeks after their marriage, and the following summer he leads a military campaign in which he oversaw the capture of Boulogne. Now, that means, of course, that he leaves the country. So in his absence, he appoints Catherine as Queen Regent.
Really?
Only the second of his wives to receive that honour after Catherine of Aragon, all the way back in 1513.
Huh.
So for several months, Catherine Parr literally rules the country, deals with a wide variety of issues and demonstrates herself as highly capable and dependable.
Wow. So... where is all this nonsense come from, then? It sounds a bit like what's her name? Lady of the Lamp.
Florence Nightingale.
Florence Nightingale's reputation that is just so much more than the only thing she's known for.
Mm. It's that, we'll talk about it in Privy Chamber a little bit more, but basically is a Victorian person that just pretty much invents it.
Right.
And then everyone just repeated it as fact. So, all very good, really. An amazing start for Catherine as queen. But, nevertheless, she, like everybody else, is still vulnerable to the machinations of Henry's court. Fueled by his tyrannical paranoia, it's very much awash with spies and informers, where a fall from grace is basically a death sentence.
Yeah. It's weird.
The dividing lines at court now are very much over religion. And obviously, you know, the conservatives, the religious conservatives versus the reformers. And when Catherine becomes queen, she's not really associated with either side. And Risley, who's now the Lord Chancellor and one of the conservatives, actually welcomes her accession and assumes that the widow of a sort of northern traditionalist and a friend to Mary must be of a conservative mindset.
Yeah.
In actual fact, Catherine is an evangelical reformer. And part of the reason that she accepts her marriage to Henry and thinks that she, but the reason that God has effectively chosen her to be queen, is because she has a mission to finish, basically finish the work that Anne Boleyn started and complete the Reformation.
Oh, wow. So she sees herself as following on from Anne Boleyn?
I don't know if she specifically sees herself, like, in relation to Anne, but absolutely
but that's what
the
we
Reformation.
Can see.
The Reformation is about making that finished and solid and perfect in a way that you can we can see.
Yeah. Oh, so we can see that connection. And so it wasn't actually... she wasn't quite as under duress as I feared then when it came to the marriage because she was seeing this as an opportunity to, as you say, finish it all off.
Yeah, so she thinks, I don't want to marry Henry. I'd rather marry Thomas Seymour. But actually, I've got something to achieve. Mm. You know, I've got to become queen to do this. That's what I'm here to do.
Crikey. She couldn't be more different then. Yeah, she's got a mission. And this is, it's not just taking things as they come. This is pushing an advantage.
Exactly. So she fills her household with like-minded individuals, even starts sort of patronising publishing religious books.
Nice.
Now, Risley and Bishop Gardiner, who's the other leading conservative figure at court, now realise that she's in fact one of their greatest enemies. And for them, in favour of their position, Henry has been veering towards a more conservative outlook in his later years. And he'd previously enjoyed having sort of theological debates with Catherine at dinner. Because, you know, he likes theology, he likes debating, but his poor health makes him increasingly irritable. Mm. And he's not so fond of it anymore. So he complains to Gardiner on one occasion. A good hearing it is when women become such clerks, and a thing much in my comfort to come in mine old days to be taught by my wife.
What's he banging on about?
She has the... She's telling me what she thinks.
Oh, teaching in that sense. Yeah. I see. Oh, gosh. Well, watch out, Henry. Gets worse.
Well, I mean, obviously, this is music to Gardiner's ears, the perfect opening for him. So he secures Henry's permission to investigate Catherine and her ladies for heresy.
Oh, haven't they had enough of this?
Absolutely not, because they are on the attack, the Conservatives. They really want to get rid of all of the reformers and have control. Because everyone's got their eyes on the fact that Henry can't be that long for this world, and then there's going to be a regency. And also, obviously, Henry appointed Catherine as regent when he left the country. They're, I guess, thinking, what happens if he appoints a regent, you know, long term after he's gone? What will she do? Now, thankfully, Catherine is warned in advance about what's going on, and she is able to secure a private meeting with Henry in which she makes a fulsome submission to him, assures him that his was the last and only voice on her on religious matters, and that her intentions had been misconstrued.
That is what all of them wanted, wasn't it? That moment to plead their case in front of Henry.
Yeah, that chance.
Otherwise, do you think if she hadn't, would she have faced the chop? Would he have been looking for a way out at this point?
We'll talk about this and battling this a little bit more. His motivation here is a little bit murkier than it usually is. But he seems to be mollified by what she says. But the next day, when they're in the Privy Garden together, Risley rocks up with an armed guard of 40 soldiers brandishing a warrant for Catherine's arrest.
Well, she's with the king.
Hmm.
He can just say, no, go away.
Well, or was he really mollified by what Catherine had said the day before?
Oh, my goodness.
Or was he just playing her? Henry asks Risley to give an explanation, and then suddenly shouts, knave! Arrant knave! Beast and fool! And dismisses Risley and the soldiers.
Oh, it was all set up, wasn't it?
Mm. So he obviously decided not to cancel the warrant because he wanted to teach Risley a lesson.
I would have thought it was teaching Catherine one, saying, look, this is what might have happened because he's actually a terrible
man.
Well,
he's teaching her, but he's also putting Risley in his place because obviously Risley and Gardner probably are trying to bring down the Queen. So different people, you could argue, are trying to manipulate Henry, and he has absolutely stamped them all down and says, no, I am in charge here. On the 28th of January, 1547, Henry VIII dies at the age of 55 and a reign of 38 years.
God, I'm surprised he got that far.
Well, yeah, to be honest, yeah. Catherine had not been with Henry for Christmas, nor was she permitted to see him in his final days, and indeed she is shocked to discover that she is not named regent for Edward VI. Henry has in fact rewritten his will a month before he died, revoking her position as regent, and instead Edward Seymour, Thomas Seymour's older brother, so the uncle of Edward VI, emerges as Lord Protector and has himself created Duke of Somerset. In terms of Henry and Catherine, perhaps Henry had grown suspicious of how Catherine would govern in religion. So although she's survived the attempt on her life, perhaps it is enough that Henry thought, still nevertheless blotted your copybook. But nevertheless, as Queen Dowager, Catherine Parr is left very wealthy. And she's also freed from the responsibilities of government, and she can pursue her own interests, chiefly the return of Thomas Seymour.
And how old is she when Henry dies?
She is about 35 when Henry dies.
So she's got loads left. Well, maybe.
Yeah, so Thomas Seymour, the man that she'd loved and wanted to marry before Henry came along, has largely been absent from court since Catherine and married Henry. Partly, as we said, sent away by Henry, but also perhaps he may have just thought it was sensible to keep his distance. But with Henry dead, he picks up where he left off. Now, initially, Catherine declares that while she was his loving wife in heart, she was determined never to marry and break it when I have done if I live 2 years. I.e., she'll observe 2 years of mourning for Henry.
Okay.
That's the done thing. But as it happens, her resistance very quickly evaporates. So in June, if not May, they marry in secret. And Catherine becomes the most married queen in English history, taking her fourth husband.
Rex fact.
Now, this is quite a controversial marriage, not just for the unseemly haste after Henry's death, but also because it's seen as something of a challenge to Somerset's regency. Because Catherine, obviously, is the Queen Dowager, is very prominent and powerful. Thomas Seymour, his brother, is also, you know, the uncle to the king, and both of them wanted a bit more of a role.
Oh,
so you can see how it's a bit...
Yeah, two uncles vying.
But still, overall, this is a happy time for Catherine. She's finally been able to choose her own husband and for love, and she oversees a substantial household as dowager, which includes Elizabeth and also Lady Jane Grey.
Oh, here she is. Well, I've got my eye on her. I'm expecting great things.
What's more, at the age of 35, Catherine is, for the first time, pregnant by Thomas Seymour.
Okay, phew. Okay, I was trying to work that out.
Their joy is diminished somewhat by Seymour's sexually flirtatious behaviour with Elizabeth.
Which ultimately
results in Elizabeth's removal from the household, while Catherine and Seymour go to Sudley Castle in the Cotswolds in preparation for Catherine's labour.
I remember this from Elizabeth's episode. So that's who the fella was, Thomas Seymour. Was Catherine Parr's husband?
Yes.
Ooh, filthy get.
Yeah, we will talk about that a little bit more later. On the 30th of August, 1548, Catherine gives birth to a healthy girl, which she names Mary, obviously in honour of Henry's oldest daughter.
Oh, nice.
A few days later, however, Catherine falls ill with purpural fever. Becomes delirious, claiming to one of her ladies, "I am not well handled," and to Seymour that he had given me many shrewd taunts and accusing him of denying her access to medical care. He manages to calm her down, but sadly there's nothing that can be done for her, and on the 5th of September 1548, just 6 days after giving birth, Catherine Parr dies at the age of 36.
Oh, no. What becomes of her daughter, Mary?
Well, so in terms of a little bit of the aftermath, Lady Jane Grey is the chief mourner at Catherine's funeral. It's potentially the first truly Protestant funeral ever held in England. So Catherine's almoner, Miles Coverdale, famous for translating the Bible, conducts the services entirely in English and with evangelical rites. Initially shaken by her death, Thomas Seymour, without Catherine there to steady him, allows his ambition to run wild. So he plots to marry Lady Jane Grey to Edward VI, marry himself to Elizabeth, and to overthrow his brother as protector. And he is arrested breaking into Edward VI's room at night with a loaded pistol and, not surprisingly, is executed for treason in 1549.
Who's going to execute
He wasn't going to kill Edward. He was going to basically abduct him and just try to make himself protector by virtue of literally having possession of the king.
And this wasn't a setup. This was real.
Oh, yeah, you did it.
Oh, God, good riddance.
So Catherine's daughter Mary is thus an orphan before she's even turned two. She went to stay with Catherine's great friend, Catherine Willoughby, the Dowager Duchess of Suffolk, but nothing is recorded of her after 1550. So sadly, it's most likely that her daughter Mary Seymour dies as an infant.
Oh, I thought it was going to end up with some lovely tale of her retiring to marry a lighthouse keeper or something.
Afraid not. There's some rumours, but it's most likely that disappearing from the record means...
Well, I'll stick with my lighthouse keeper story. It's a nicer one.
Anyway, that was the life and queenship of Catherine Parr. We will review her after a quick break.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
I meant those blackout motorized shades.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. I installed these and then got some from my mom, too. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Hall of Fame son.
They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 40% off. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
The Dine Under menu is here for a limited time at Outback Steakhouse. Get an 18-ounce bone-in ribeye and our signature blend of 17 spices, Kingsland pasta, or juicy sirloin and lobster mac starting at just $16.99. That's better than the actual Outback, where even if you caught dinner, you know deep down you couldn't do what needs to be done. Run free, little buddy. Run free. The Dine Under menu. It's better than the actual Outback. Starting at $16.99 for a limited time at Outback Steakhouse. Outback. No rules, just right.
Whether you're working out or working on your high score, you never settle for less. So why should it be any different when you choose your protein drink? Rockin' Protein comes in three delicious flavors, has 30 grams of protein, and is always made with fresh milk, so you're never left with that chalky taste. Rockin' Protein. Never settle for less than a great-tasting, high-quality protein drink. Visit rockinprotein.com to find Rockin' Protein wherever you are. Rockin' Protein and Shamrock Farms are registered trademarks of Shamrock Foods Company.
Battleliness!
Catherine's mother gave her a sense of agency that wasn't to be confined by her gender, and she takes great pride in her family origins. She continues to sign documents with her maiden name, i.e. Catherine Parr, even when queen.
Cool!
And as we were saying, although she hadn't wanted to marry Henry, she believed she had a divine mission to fulfil the role of queen, so despite knowing the dangers, she endeavours to make something of it and leave her mark on history. Which again is quite, you know, in terms of agency.
Yeah.
Yes, she didn't have the choice in marrying, really. But once she accepted that, she was like, right, well, I'm going
to
do something.
No, she used it. She used it to her. She might, yeah. That is exactly what battliness is in this series.
Hmm.
But more so, she had a mission set out and said, this is how I'm going to achieve it.
And of course, she has more freedom of choice once Henry dies. And again, immediately took advantage of it, marrying her own choice as husband, in spite of how it would be received at court. That said, though, she wouldn't stand for it when Somerset takes some actions against her. So he confiscated jewels that had been left to her in Henry's will and then interfered in the running of some of her estates. So she wrote to Thomas Seymour after an encounter with his brother. "My lord, your brother hath this afternoon made me a little warm. It was fortunate we were so distant, for else I suppose I should have bitten him."
Would have bitten him. Yeah, quite right.
Now, Catherine has real authority as queen. So in 1543, she had quite an important role in the Anglo-Spanish diplomacy ahead of the war against France. So she welcomes and entertains two visiting dukes on different occasions, all of which sort of helps facilitate the alliance. And that's something that she seems to have done without Henry's supervision or guidance. That's in contrast, we might recall Jane Seymour when she met Chapuis. She was very much kept on a leash with sort of Henry just to one side, and then swoops in once she starts talking about Mary, and he thinks, oh, that's a bit of a
Yeah.
Now, we'll discuss the regency in a little bit more detail in subjectivity, but A, it's worth noting in terms of power and agency, she literally does rule the country for a few months. Mm-hmm. But also, it speaks to us of her ambition, because she probably does see it as a trial run for the likely regency of Edward VI. And she gives very detailed updates for Henry, which ensures that he knows exactly what a good job she's doing.
It's The Apprentice and Alan Sugar.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that Catherine had expected to be regent to Edward VI is shown by the fact that her first couple of letters she writes after Henry's death are signed Queen Regent. And she even sought legal opinion on whether she was actually entitled to the role. So she does, you know, she's like, I do want this power, by the way, just in case anyone was in doubt.
Anyone else ask? Yeah.
Yeah.
My aunt is very much in the ring for this. Yeah. She's cool. Really punchy.
With Cromwell dead, religious conservatives are tightening their grip at court. But David Starkey's argued that Catherine's arrival marks the point at which the tide turns in favour of reformers. Mm. Gardiner's actually been plotting the destruction of the Archbishop of Canterbury himself, Thomas Cranmer. And he also then indicted many lower-ranking courtiers in Henry's household for heresy as part of this big move against reformers at court. However, one of Catherine's servants had secretly been sent to observe the trial, and once the verdict is in, he rushes back to warn one of those who'd been indicted, resulting in the papers from the trial being intercepted and the news getting to Henry.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry is furious that an attack has been made against his own servants without his permission, and he grants them all a pardon. Henry also decides to protect Cranmer from any further attacks, so Gardiner's machinations are undone. But then it's sort of in the background, but it does feel like Catherine's arrival is just the thing which nips it in the bud a bit and turns it. Now, after this, Gardiner and Risley seek to have Catherine herself condemned as a heretic. And Henry, as I said, is a bit of a murky what Henry's up to, because he does seem to have arranged for Catherine to be made aware of the accusations against her. But that doesn't mean that she wasn't in any danger. And instead, as Catherine realises, what's probably happening is that she is being tested. So she can save herself, but equally, if her response had been misjudged or not been what Henry wanted to hear, could still have meant death. Henry immediately, and rather provocatively, of course, turns the subject to religion. So in response, Catherine's straight in there, knows what she wants to say, and she declares herself a silly poor woman, assuring him that she did refer my judgment in this and in all other cases to your majesty's wisdom. But Henry is not going to let her get away with it that easily, so he answers, not so, by St. Mary, you are become a doctor, Kate, to instruct us, as we take it, and not to be instructed or directed by us. So to this, Catherine answers, if your majesty take it so, then hath your majesty very much mistaken me, who have ever been of the opinion to think it very unseemly and preposterous for the woman to take upon her the office of an instructor or teacher to her lord and husband. And whereas I have, with your majesty's leave, heretofore been bold to hold talk with your majesty, wherein sometimes in opinions there hath seemed some difference, I did it rather to minister talk, not only to the end your majesty might with less grief pass over this painful time of your infirmity, but also that I, hearing your majesty's learned discourse, might receive to myself some profit thereby. So in other words, I wasn't putting forward my opinions, I just thought you liked to talk and it could help distract you from your illness and pain, and then I would learn from talking to you the true way.
It's a good reply. I haven't quite got to the bottom of why she is fighting for her life yet, though.
Because she's being put on trial for heresy.
Right.
So any time I've said something which goes against what you have put down in law as the true faith, it was simply to provoke, interesting discussion and for me to learn from you by your correction. I wasn't advancing heretical views.
Mm. Okay.
To which Henry says, is it even so, sweetheart? And tended your arguments to nowhere's end? Then perfect friends we are now again, as ever at any time heretofore.
I'm still the boss. You still think I'm right in all things? Jolly yes. Good.
And what's more, her survival really does mark the end of the conservative ascendancy, and the reformers, of course, are the ones who control the regency of Edward VI. So although she is not regent, you can see her survival here is almost that sort of last, that moment that What am I trying to
so
say?
So did she blow it? I mean, she survived, but was it at the expense of her mission?
You could say that she's perhaps a bit culpable in her brush with death. She maybe became a bit overconfident, maybe made that usually fatal error of thinking that she could control or at least manipulate Henry. And yeah, her survival does come at a cost. She's forced to stay well clear of religion for the rest of Henry's reign. And as we said, her role as regent is revoked in his will. Oddly, perhaps you could see that in a weird way as something of a compliment, because in 1544, he'd appreciated her abilities to rule and made her regent. In 1546, he maybe sees just how able she is and what she might do when left unchecked. And that's why he takes it away from her. So in a weird way, it's sort of a compliment in a way that he takes it away from her, because he's like, no, actually, you really would do something.
Yeah.
So a score for battliness for Catherine Parr.
It's brilliant. And actually, I mean, maybe she was complicit in her that moment of downfall, if it was one, but she survived it. And I like the survivor instinct. You know, she didn't do an Anne Boleyn and push it too far.
Unfortunately, Scotland didn't invade with a massive army, like with Catherine of Aragon, so we don't get to see her sort of martial credentials on display.
I feel this, like she has similar character traits to Catherine. I can imagine her dealing with that very deftly.
It's a shame in a way that like she survives an attack against her. It's not that she kind of, I don't know, goes completely full circle and
then gets retribution.
Yeah.
I quite like that she decides just to survive. But it's very good. I mean, she can't help it that she didn't have a battle.
Yeah.
7.
Yeah, I think 7 as well. Yeah, I don't think it's like, you know, we've had ones who've got more than that and a bit higher up there. But no, it's impressive. She has agency. She does stuff with the power. And she survives an attack on herself. So I think
it's someone scoring 7 on the opening day of Strictly. And Henry VIII is also a competitor, so has the power to say, no, you're not playing, actually. That's a bit, bit too good.
So, 7 from you, 7 from me, 14 for battliness.
Scandal!
Well, as you said, her marriage to Thomas Seymour created quite a stir. As you said, for one thing, it was all unseemly haste. It was meant to be 2 months of mourning, and instead they marry after about 3 or 4 months. 2 years of mourning.
2 years, yeah.
But
yeah,
they
yeah.
marry after 3 or 4 months. Mary noted that her father's death was at yet very ripe in her own remembrance, and considered it strange news. While Elizabeth, apparently outraged at seeing the ashes, or rather the scarcely cold body of the king our father, so shamefully dishonoured by the queen our stepmother.
It's got something of Mary Queen of Scots about it.
The marriage also has political ramifications, though. Now, one thing you were asking when I said about her being pregnant, and you wanted clarification over, you know, is that Thomas Seymour? But that was actually a really genuinely important question, because if she had fallen very quickly pregnant by Thomas Seymour, feasibly, even if it was Seymour's child, they could have attributed the paternity to Henry and thus disrupt the line of succession.
Yeah.
Obviously, Edward is still king, but Mary and Elizabeth would then get bumped down.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, that doesn't occur, but still, Catherine and Seymour do possess two of the most senior figures in the line of succession in the form of Elizabeth and Lady Jane Grey. And it's easy to see why Somerset would have seen this relationship as a challenge to his authority. Catherine suggests, knowing that the marriage won't be popular, that they seek support at court. So Seymour visits Edward whilst Somerset is campaigning in Scotland, and he basically dictates a letter in which Edward pledges to ensure that Somerset would not be troublesome about the marriage. And, you know, it is a marriage of passion, but it is also an alliance of two people who felt they deserved more prominency in the regency.
Yeah.
Despite being her legal guardian and effective surrogate father, as you said, Seymour takes a sexual interest in Elizabeth, visiting her in her chambers early in the morning, where he apparently struck her upon the back or buttocks familiarly.
Yeah.
Now, Elizabeth's lady, Cat Ashley, tells Catherine of her concerns about Seymour's behaviour, but Catherine seems to have dismissed it as playful behaviour, and she's either unable or perhaps just unwilling to see what's actually happening. So on 2 occasions, she actually joined Seymour on morning visits into Elizabeth's chambers, where they both tickle her in bed.
To normalise it? How old was Elizabeth?
She's 14 at this point.
Not typically wanting a tickle from the stepmother and stepfather?
No. And then Cat Ashley recalls another occasion where Seymour romped with her in the garden and cut her gown, being black cloth, into 100 pieces. And when this deponent, i.e. when Elizabeth, came upon... Oh no, sorry, her, when Cat Ashley came upon and chided Lady Elizabeth, she answered that she could not strive withal, for the Queen held her while the Lord Admiral cut her dress.
Oh dear.
Now, ultimately, she can't deny reality indefinitely, so as Cat Ashley recalled, the Queen was jealous over her and him, insomuch that one time the Queen, suspecting the often access of the Admiral to the Lady Elizabeth's grace, came suddenly upon them where they were all alone, he having her in his arms.
Oh, man. Oh, dear, I feel like she's complicit in this.
Yeah, now, Elizabeth, as I said, only 14 years old, so obviously we would today classify this as child abuse.
Mm.
And, you know, and it is, but I'd say contemporaries would have seen Elizabeth as answerable to her own actions. We said before about, you know, sort of the age, effective age of consent being a lot lower for the Tudors, so they would have seen Elizabeth as
as someone with agency in this.
Yeah. So when Elizabeth departs, or just before Elizabeth departs, Catherine has a sort of last interview with her and warns her of the dangers to her reputation that could be caused by such conduct. And Elizabeth apparently answered little, which was considered notable, given that usually she would resist any reproofs on her character. Mm. Thankfully, they do patch things up again afterwards and are writing affectionately. They do bury the hatchet, as it were, before Catherine dies. And obviously you would say, you know, the real main offence there is Seymour's, but equally, as you said, Catherine is sort of complicit in this, very much not her finest.
Yeah, it feels like it's a completely different thing. That twisted relationship with this Thomas character at the end, with Elizabeth, feels like a psychological thriller where someone's been put through. I don't know. She's been through a lot, and I feel like maybe there's some pressure being put on her from this Thomas guy, and she's going with it, and it's all a bit weird.
I'm not sure if Catherine Parr's being put under pressure by Thomas Seymour, but you can see the psychology that, you know, that he's the one that she's wanted to marry, and she's assumed that he's felt the same way. They've got married. She's pregnant as well, just at this point. So she's sort of thinking, no, there's no, this can't be what's happening.
Mm. And it is scandalous in the day as well. It's not just us looking.
Oh yeah,
back
there's
on
lots
it.
Of rumours about it because, you know, I mean, Elizabeth, you know, is almost on charge for treason as well, because actually, because he is planning, talking about marrying Elizabeth, the relationship at this point is discussed when she is questioned. So, yeah, so it is a scandalous thing at the time. And obviously the scandal is connected with Elizabeth and Thomas Seymour, really.
Oh, that's true. How much do we blame... It is Catherine Parr we have to decide. Mm. Yeah.
It's a poor judgment at this point.
So, still, good scandal.
Yes, indeed, yes. So we've got the marriage in the first place and the fact that it's controversial. It's very soon after Henry having those royal children in the household and the question of whether they're manoeuvring a little bit against Somerset, the fact they both wanted the regency or involvement in the regency. And then this.
I think it's pretty good. Don't you think? I mean, she
feel like it's not bad.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know if
half full, half empty.
Well, yeah,
not
exactly.
Bad, pretty good. I feel like a 7 again. 6, maybe. 6.
Yeah, I was thinking more like a 5.5 or a 6. I don't. It's not quite. Nothing is quite
nothing
there
sticks.
Enough. Like the Regency stuff and with Thomas Seymour, it's like, yeah, it is. It's a bit. Ooh, but there isn't quite anything they do which is really scandalous there. And the Elizabeth thing obviously is a very scandalous thing that happens. But again, it's more Thomas Seymour doing it, and while she is complicit, that's not quite the same.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
So yeah, I think I'll go 5.5. I feel like it's just above the middle bit, but nothing quite lands for me to be high.
Yeah, all right, 6. I'll stick with 6.
So 6 for you, 5.5 for me. That's 11.5 for scandal.
Subjectivity.
So Catherine becomes queen 10 years after Anne Boleyn, which is a decade that's been, to say the least, disruptive for the royal family. But Catherine brings a real sense of Henry and his children being a family for the first time.
Yeah.
So they actually live under one roof on various occasions, and it's obviously considered unusual because Mary of Hungary, the regent of the Netherlands, wrote to Chapuis in 1543 asking whether they continued still in one household.
Oh, right. Well, it's unusual for Henry. Is it unusual for the time?
I think it's more Henry.
Okay. So it's not like she's saying, oh, my God, they actually live all under the one roof.
Yeah. And beyond just the nicety of happy family, so as I said, it had a lasting significance because Mary and Elizabeth were restored to the line of succession, and many contemporaries do attribute Catherine as being a key factor in making that happen.
Good. Well done.
She also has a positive impact on the three children as people. So Mary seems to have come out of her shell and enjoys herself at court a little bit more after a decade of hardship. Now, Edward, of course, is always cherished by Henry as the long-awaited son and heir, but it's always a rather distant affection, and he never has a mother figure in his life until Catherine comes along.
And they share the same religious beliefs.
Same religious beliefs, also both very scholarly. He sends her various letters to his most dear mother. But the most profound influence is had on Elizabeth. Catherine is a mother figure to Elizabeth from the very formative ages of 9 to 15.
Mm.
And she's a very important figure in shaping the woman and queen Elizabeth would become. Elizabeth is at Catherine's side when Catherine Parr serves as regent of the country. So at this impressionable age, Elizabeth sees the country being ruled confidently and effectively by a woman who's receiving the formal submissions of business from male councillors before giving them their instructions based on her judgment. So as David Starkey observed, Elizabeth saw a court fronted by a woman and managed by a council. Between them, they successfully ran a country racked by war, plague and religious division. It could have served as a precedent for her own government as queen. So obviously shaping the queenship of Elizabeth I is quite the legacy, but Catherine achieves much as queen in her own right. She's a significant patron in various disciplines. She commissions leading artists in portrait and miniatures, including Susanna Horrenbode, Lavina Teerlink and Margaret Holswither, who are the first known female artists in England.
Hmm.
She loves books and promotes the art of bookbinding.
Hang on, first female artists?
First known female artists in England. So, they are named employed at court.
That's brilliant. Oh, well, girl power.
In 1544, she helps publish an ABC primer to help children learn to read in their own language.
She's Dolly Parton.
She had a love of learning, so she continues her studies as an adult, so she learns Spanish while she's queen, as well as interceding with Henry to protect Cambridge University from dissolution when a categorisation was made that could let Henry do that if he chose to. And as a result, instead of dissolving it, they end up founding Trinity College instead.
Ha! She is Dolly Parton!
Now, the high watermark of her queenship, of course, is when she became regent less than a year after becoming queen. And this is a significant show of faith in Catherine's abilities on Henry's part. Obviously, it's only Catherine of Aragon that got that honour before, and Catherine was the daughter of two reigning monarchs.
Yeah.
But his faith is well rewarded. She proved herself a highly capable administrator, issued proclamations on issues such as the status of French residents, army deserters and outbreaks of plague. And she shows particular skill and knowledge in the challenges of the Anglo-Scottish border. Perhaps, obviously, having been up in the north, she maybe got a little bit more of a sense of it. So the report sent to her that Scottish prisoners in the north were likely to die if money was not sent to feed them. But there was an issue with plague in various other sort of northeastern towns.
Mm.
So Catherine quickly writes back commanding that those of the poorer sort who are stout, busy or otherwise like to do any hurt being at liberty should be sent to a variety of prisons around the north, whilst others, if extreme necessity shall require, could be fed at the king's expense and the rest shall be released upon a bond for good behaviour.
Oh, right. So, I mean, I'm taking that as a positive, presumably.
Absolute rot, worst of the rotters who are going to cause trouble, stick them in prisons, but different ones to sort of spread it out and whatnot.
Clever.
Others, if we've got to feed them, we've got to feed them. But the rest of them, let's just send them home.
Yeah, brilliant.
Her greatest legacy, though, is helping to shape the Protestant Reformation that would be fully realised under Edward VI and Elizabeth I. She turned her household into what David Starkey has described as a Tudor Open University course in religion. So each afternoon, one of her chaplains would preach a sermon to Catherine and her household in her privy chamber, attacking abuses in traditional church beliefs. And this educational culture has a real legacy because a lot of the next generation of leading and particularly female religious thinkers in England are part of Catherine's household. So it's sort of their schooling in a way.
Oh my gosh, she's amazing.
However, she doesn't just operate behind closed doors. She also herself authors and publishes devotional works, which makes her the first English consort to be published, as well as the first English woman in the 16th century.
I mean, Rex, facts are bouncing all this room like bouncy balls.
So the first, which is published anonymously in 1544, was Psalms and Psalms or Prayers, which is a translation of works by Bishop Fisher from 1525, which Catherine reworks to be relevant for reform.
I was so hoping you were going to say to be smutty.
But it also, well, it's sort of not smutty, but it does also serve weirdly as wartime propaganda. Because lots of the psalms that she includes are focused on defeating enemies, and it's published at the same time that Henry is going off to fight in France. And so the ninth psalm, which is one of them in the book, is actually set to some pre-existing music by Thomas Tallis and performed as part of a wartime service at St. Paul's Cathedral.
Wow. It's like Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover.
Mm. And her A Prayer for the King is inserted into the Book of Common Prayer in 1559, most likely by Elizabeth, and it remains the prayer that's used by Anglican communities to pray for the monarch today.
Really?
Hmm.
Huh.
Now, the first work published in her own name was Prayers or Meditations in 1545, with a title page noting that they were collected out of certain holy works by the most virtuous and gracious princess, Catherine, Queen of England. Her final work is The Lamentations of a Sinner, which is written in 1546, but after her brush with death, not published until after Henry's death in 1547. This was a much more personal and original work. So rather than being a translation, it's written in the first person, with Catherine castigating her former self for adhering to old religious habits, before then describing her acceptance of Protestant tenets such as justification by faith alone. Now, this was less popular than her other two works, both of which ran through about 20 editions over the next 50 years. But it does very much support the Protestant theology of Edward VI's government. It has a preface written by William Cecil, who's the future chief minister to Elizabeth I, and has been described by her biographer Susan James as a remarkable book.
She is a very bright bean.
Mm.
I like her, Graham. I like her a lot.
Against her, she isn't queen for very long, which obviously is beyond her control. But obviously, but that does mean that she doesn't get that long. Now, you could say she achieves an awful lot in in a short time. In some ways, it's more impressive that she does all this.
Mm.
You could also say her marriage to Thomas Seymour could be viewed as a mistake that does lose her a bit of credibility and loses her some influence at court. Of course, it's hard to know how serious or long-lasting this was because of her own tragic death so soon afterwards.
I think, subjectivity-wise, would I want her to be queen? And I think I'm going to scrub the Thomas what's-his-name stuff.
Mm.
And during the time that she was queen, unless I were Catholic, absolutely yes. And certainly if I was a woman. She's awesome. Was it? And she's just known for being someone mopping Henry's brow.
Yeah.
Useless Henry by this point. But she's out there doing all this educational stuff, like Dolly Parton. Yeehaw! It's Catherine Parr. I really like it. I think eight.
Yeah, I'm thinking even higher for this. I'm thinking. I mean, it's the only thing that I'm reticent about is the fact that it's not very long. But equally, she fits an awful lot into not very long. And you think, particularly, you know, if this was 100 years earlier and I just picked three of those things and said that's what we've got, we think, oh yeah, that's really good, oh, a six or seven or something. So
yeah,
to have actually true. Just really do stuff, you know, all the, you know, literally writing and publishing her own book.
Yeah, that's so true. I think I'm only doing eight because I'm being held down by this image of her, this nightingale image. Each one of these things is amazing.
And I think sort of looking back at this, the six wives, they've got their different qualities and things you like about them. I don't know, they feel something a bit more like she's the one that's maybe a bit more...
I'd like to be mates with her best. She's the best one.
So for subjectivity, I'm going 9.
I will gladly match you.
So that is 18 subjectivity.
Longevity.
Well, obviously, as we've just been saying there, not so long as Queen, unfortunately. So she is Queen Consort from the 12th of July, 1543, to the 28th of January, 1547, which is the death of Henry VIII. So 3.5 years, which gives her a score of 5, which is the 45th best overall. Though, remarkably, it is the second best among the six wives.
Really?
6 months longer than Anne Boleyn, actually, as Queen.
Huh. Wow. Mm. Good for her. Team Catherine. Pa.
Dynasty.
not the present.
Sadly, no children by Henry VIII, which gives her a score of 0 for dynasty and a joint 42nd. That's brought her down, obviously, those last two. So her total score is 48.5, which will put her in joint 15th with Eleanor of Castile.
Still,
it's not all about the scores. Does she have that certain something, that great achievement and lasting legacy that we call
Rex Factor?
I'm saying absolutely yes. This is the purpose of this podcast. We've got to reveal all those people who are in Henry VIII's shadow behind in the big book of Kings and Queens. She was awesome.
Married 4 times. She was in at the deep end of the Pilgrimage of Grace, survives the plot on her life, powerful and influential queen, restores Mary and Elizabeth to the succession, rules as regent, first consort to publish a book, helps shape the Protestant theology of Edward and Elizabeth, on whom she has, you know, profound influence. And also something I found quite interesting, it's easy to get inured to the story of Henry's wives. It sort of feel like it kind of follows a very familiar pattern and can get all a bit too familiar. But it's also the end of a story, not just of Henry, but of English queens. So of the 9 queens we've had from Elizabeth Woodville to Catherine Parr, all but 2 have been English. There won't be another native consort until Elizabeth Bowes Lyon in 1936, 389 years later.
Wow.
Which is almost exactly the same gap as from the Battle of Hastings to Elizabeth Woodville, which is 398 years. We had Matilda of Scotland, obviously, but... And technically, of course, you know, we said Matilda of Scotland there that I'm not counting. You could argue Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, she is the daughter of the Lord of Glamis, who is a Scottish nobleman.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to treat Elizabeth Bowes Lyon as Scottish, then that would mean that there wasn't another English consort until 2022.
Wow. I mean, that is a Rex fact for us to chew on, isn't it? Take that with a big old glug of water, because that's going to be hard to digest.
Yeah, I agree with you. I really like Catherine Parr. I think she's really interesting. She's really capable. I like her attitude. She gets stuff done in a really short space of time. Does leave genuine legacies, you know, the book she does, The Protestant Reformation, the influence on Elizabeth, and she does some really impressive things. I think she's a really good queen consort. Yes, it's very short, but she packs an awful lot in. So I'm also going to say yes to Catherine Parr, getting the Rex Factor. Catherine Parr. She joins Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn, as well as all the other ones we had before, on that Rex Factor mountain for the consorts.
3 out of 6.
Correspondence Corner.
So that was Catherine Parr. Let us know what you thought about her. We're doing a right of reply episode for the 6 wives, so let us know what you thought about them. Any surprises, who's been your favourite, anything you disagree with. As we said at the start, find us on Twitter and Instagram at Rex Factor Pod. Like the Rex Factor Podcast Facebook page, email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com, and remember to send in your hashtag consort cards for an episode image for Catherine Parr, and be in with a chance of winning a Rex Factor Henry VIII or Mary Queen of Scots figurine.
Join on Patreon and join in the Discord chat, because that's where we hang out.
And you also get access to over 150 bonus episodes on Patreon. So we welcome some new Privy Councillors: Ali Gibbs, Corfney Donhall, Catriona Lawler, Leah Denman, David Davies, Patricia Huber, Therese Scholblom, Jackie Stockley, Ellen Streitlin, Christina Morgotcha, Matt and Electra Esquire, Alison P. Sherwin, Judith 621, Alex Whitmarsh, Alexander Ascott, John Peter Candlin, Tommy Wood, Heather Campbell, Dr. Davis, Marion Rett, Chris Thomas, Sarah Gabby, Angela Bowers, Douglas Thompson, Jason Smith, and Jeff and Gerald.
Hey! Hello, welcome, thank you very much. Get involved, it's lovely to have you here.
So that is all from us today, and that is all for the 6 Wives of Henry VIII. 9 episodes, and our odyssey is complete. Next time we'll be doing the Right of Reply episode for the 6 Wives. We've got a few interviews lined up. Special episode will be coming up for patrons or for purchase on Catherine de' Medici, and then we will get started on the Stuart consorts, albeit starting with Philip II of Spain.
I can't wait. Well done, that's been a slog.
It has indeed. A good slog, hopefully.
Cheerio!